Don't mind if you got something nice to say about me. I enjoy an accolade like the rest. You could take my picture and hang it in.
Good morning and welcome to Solutions Live Business Edition. I'm your host, Chickie Fitzgerald, coming to you from Tampa, Florida. Solutions Live provides practical advice from authors and experts on a wide range of topics for professionals to help you leave your legacy. Today we have an amazing lineup to talk about innovation, leadership, growth, and investment insights.
It is Tuesday, February 24th, and this is Chickie Fitzgerald, and it is another sunny day in Tampa, Florida. Big surprise. Our sponsor today is TripSandbox.com. If you need to get away, check out TripSandbox.com. There are some amazing weekend getaways, some terrific cruise deals. In fact, I think these days you can cruise cheaper than you can stay home. Welcome today to Chris Bradshaw, my co-host, coming to us from Dallas, Texas. Chris. Good morning.
Good morning, Chickie. Thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to today's set of authors.
Oh, it's just incredible. And Chris and I have formed this amazing, what we call the New Book Club, which Chris and I both have a passion for reading. And so it is just like the best thing ever to be able to not only read these books, but to talk to the authors and then talk about it afterwards. So we're going to start this morning. Our first guest is going to be Pamela Skillings, who I'll come back to in a minute and tell you all about her. At 10:30, we will have Susan Steinbrecher, who wrote Heart-Centered Leadership. And I love the tagline from this book, Chris. It's an invitation to lead from the inside out.
How nice.
And we have both been on the receiving end of the command and control style leadership, so I am really interested to hear about Susan's research. And then back by popular demand at 11 o'clock is Joe Pine, who has written a ton of books, but his most recent is Authenticity. We're going to be talking with him about branding and just how to grow your business. So without further ado, let's get our first guest on the air. Good morning, Pamela. Pamela, do I have you there?
Pamela. I'm sure she's either on mute and doesn't realize it, which I think we've all done on many of the conference calls that we have to do these days.
Well, while we're waiting for her to realize that we can't hear her, Pamela, if you can hear us, please just hang up and call back in, and we'll bring you back on the air again. Pamela's book, actually I told her the story when I called her to see if she could be on the show. Saturday I went to the library, Chris, with my 8-year-old son, and my husband had asked me to stop and get a book that he needed. And I'm so glad that he did, because otherwise I would have just gone into the kids' side of the library. And anyway, I went into the business section and couldn't find the book he wanted, but this book literally jumped off the shelf at me. It is called Escape from Corporate America, and the tagline on the book is a practical guide to creating the career of your dreams. Now, I see she has called back in, so hang on just one second. Let me get her on the air.
Hi there. Can you hear me
Pamela,
now?
I can. You are on the air.
Excellent. Good. I don't know what happened. I guess I got in the wrong queue or something, but I'm very happy to be here this morning.
Well, we could see you, but you just couldn't hear us, and that's okay. Actually, that is the first technical glitch we've had in the 8 weeks we've been on the air, so that's not so bad.
Pretty good, yeah.
Well, Pamela, as I told you when I reached out to you to get you on the show, your book resonated with me for a whole bunch of reasons. First of all, is that I am actually a corporate escape artist, which is the term that you gave to the people who you outlined in your book. So why don't you tell us first a little bit about yourself and how you got to the point where you decided that you needed to write a book?
Yeah, well, actually, it all started with my own experience. I am also a corporate escape artist, and my whole journey of figuring out that I did not belong in corporate America. I spent about 12 years climbing the corporate ladder and scoring those promotions and getting those raises and feeling like I was doing all the things that I was supposed to do to succeed and not feeling happy about it. And so finally, I decided that I really had to leave and go out on my own. And it was difficult to figure out how to do that. I didn't have a lot of role models at that time. I didn't know a lot of people who had done it. So it took me longer than I'm hoping it will take people who read my book and want to do similar things. So that's really a big part of why I wrote the book, because there are so many people out there who have successfully made major career changes, and I wanted people who feel stuck to know that and to learn the lessons and the best practices that those who've gone before them have used.
Very cool. And how long did it take you to write the book?
I like to say, my whole career was a part of the research. So in that sense, it took many years. But once I actually sat down to write it, I think, it took less than a year to do the actual writing part of it.
And you did a number of interviews. How many folks did you interview for the book?
Oh, wow. I spoke with hundreds of people. I did in-depth one-on-one interviews with, I think, around 80-some people, and I did a lot of online surveys and other types of surveys as well. So I really wanted to get a full idea of all the different people who are out there, all their experiences, and the different paths that they've taken.
Very interesting. Well, we've already got a question from one of our listeners, which is always a great way to start the day. Our listener wants to know how many small businesses can evolve, particularly in the new green economy that is coming from this whole corporate rundown.
Great question.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is a huge opportunity. One of the things I hear a lot is, well, isn't this a terrible market for small business, for entrepreneurs? And the truth is that if you find the right segment, the right opportunity, this could be a great time for opportunity. And I think green business is one of those areas, because regardless of what's happening in the economy, and even because in some ways of what's happening in the economy, companies and people are going green, and companies that can help them do that have a real opportunity.
Well, one of the things that we wanted to focus on this morning, and for those who are listening, we are also having Pamela on this afternoon. We're doing a special series on career transition for those who are actually thinking about jumping ship from corporate America and talking about how to take that first step, because, the first one's the biggest one. But once you've made it, it's pretty incredible. So she is going to be on again at 3 o'clock this afternoon, addressing kind of the personal career side of this. But what I'd like to talk about this morning is innovation and the innovation that you saw from these people and perhaps how it burned in them while they were still employed corporately.
Yeah, actually, it's one of the common things that I saw across the board with a lot of the people who felt compelled to escape from corporate America. It was because they felt that their creativity and their innovative talents didn't have an outlet or weren't able to be fully utilized in the corporate world. A lot of big companies are just not structured that way. It's very hard to do something new and creative and innovative in a big company. Not all, but many. So I think that was one of the things that drove a lot of the people. I think a lot of people who feel compelled to escape are some of the more innovative people that I've met in my life.
Well, what have you seen, as you took a look at all the folks that you interviewed for the book, tell us a couple that really stood out.
Oh, yeah, there's so many stories that I love, and they represent a lot of different pathways, which just goes to show that whatever your passion is, there are people who have who've probably done something that you can learn from. So, for example, Scott Adams, most of us know who that is. He's the creator of Dilbert. And the reason that he's able to write so well about the corporate world is because he was also a corporate escape artist. He spent many years working for a bank and for a telecom company before he left to pursue his comic strip full-time. And he actually spent many years doing both, maybe not many years, but at least a couple of years doing both his comic strip and working in his corporate job until he was ready to make his escape.
Pamela, this is Chris. One of my favorite things when I talk to authors, especially about books like this, where you're actually giving someone perhaps that final push to do something, and they've picked this up because they're asking to be pushed over the fence, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes one of my favorite things is to hear maybe from the readers. And have you heard any good stories from readers since who were able to do that with this just by reading something that you wrote?
Yeah, absolutely. I certainly don't want to take credit because anyone who makes a big escape like that, you know, it has to come from them. But I definitely have heard from people who've said that reading the book was sort of that last, you know, sign for them to that they, once they saw the book, that sort of gave them that final push to go out on their own. And in this economy, one of the things I'm hearing lately is a lot of readers contacting me to say that they've been laid off and they've never actually kind of had the guts to leave, even though they wanted to. But now that they've been laid off, they're seeing that as an opportunity, and they're using the book as a way to help them get started on their new career in their transition, as we're going to talk about later, now that they sort of have been pushed out of corporate America.
Right, so that's the final push they needed. The book is just, oh my gosh, here I am. I wished for it, and maybe it came true.
Yeah, someone else pushed them, and now they're figuring out how to turn that into an opportunity.
Well, and one of the things that you talk about is that there actually has to be a plan for that escape. And, you know, again, I think as we look at the title of this particular show segment of innovation, that, you know, I was sharing last week on the show that, you know, I never had the aspiration of having a radio show. And, I mean, this week I'm doing 17 different shows. So, you know, sometimes that comes out of left field. And other times that innovation and that desire to reinvent something actually is something that people try to do in corporations and you know, just can't get accomplished. And, you know, my story just very, very quickly is I spent the better part of my career, 20 years in corporate life in the travel technology field, and never felt like I belonged. You know, I just didn't fit. I thought differently than other people, and now I can look back and realize it's because I was an entrepreneur. Did you hear similar kinds of things from the people that you interviewed?
Yeah, absolutely, and I felt that way myself. I think one of the hardest things about feeling stuck in corporate America, you know, people say, well, it's not so bad, at least you have a job, and, you know, that's true, but they don't think about how exhausting it is to go into work every day, and there are usually long days in the corporate world, and pretend to be someone that you're not, and, you know, put on a mask and try to fit in and feel like you're not doing the things that you're good at or the things that you feel are meaningful. So, I mean, it definitely does take a toll on you mentally, emotionally, and physically. I talked to a lot of people who got sick because they hated their jobs. And, you know, I'm sure it was partly because they were suppressing and they were stressed out. But, you know, people who put on 50 pounds, one gentleman put on 50 pounds, someone else developed a terrible ulcer. A lot of situations where people's health was impacted. So it definitely can be powerful to be in a situation like that.
One of our listeners has another question, wondering if this is a book that's designed to keep people from returning to corporate America.
Well, it definitely is. If you don't want to return, then I hope that it is. but I would not say that I don't think anyone should work in corporate America. Obviously, you know, our economy does need corporations, and the truth is that some people thrive in corporate jobs. You know, some people really do like to have that structure, providing that it's a good corporation, it's a company that is operating ethically and all of that. But I wouldn't say that I'm saying everyone should stay out of corporate America. If you want to stay out of corporate America, I want to help you do that. But there are people that I interviewed actually who go back and forth, who actually can survive in corporate America, and they'll do a stint there because a job seems interesting or challenging to them, or perhaps for personal reasons they have financial obligations. You know, one gentleman, you know, his wife was having a baby, so he took a corporate job for a couple of years, and then he went back out and started another business. So I think in all cases, you have to make things work for you. Don't let the corporation run you. If you're going to work in corporate America, make sure that you're in charge of your career and you're making that choice.
I think we all know a lot of people like that, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I was remembering, actually on my launch show on February 3rd for the Solutions Live show, I interviewed Nancy Woodman, the former CEO of CBS Radio, and she wrote a great book called I Didn't See It Coming. And I think that there are a number of people just like Nancy who were very, very comfortable in corporate life and, you know, comfortable with the paycheck and the perks. You know, if you happen to be fortunate enough to be in that kind of a senior role. But, you know, Nancy pointed out the same thing that you do, that you really do need to plan your escape, and a lot of people get very, very comfortable. Now, I mean, I don't think comfort describes the corporate job market right now, and Chris is a recent escape artist, you know, from a major consulting firm. And, you know, so maybe I can let her give you her ideas about security in corporate America today.
Sounds like she has a very current perspective.
I do, but, you know, I'm not alone. You know, I was talking to someone else the other day, and they were talking about how they had left the Internet space after all the bubbles and everything, right, and gone into the home building segment, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, thinking that that was such a safer place. And I think that's really the point in today's economy, is regardless of which industry you're in, I mean, who would have thought that Wall Street is the blue chip world in a sense, right? Who would have thought that that would be a place with the largest percentage of layoffs or banks or anything else? So I think all of this is what's making books like yours and this issue of who are you, who do you need to be, because knowing that may be the biggest investment I think we can make in ourselves and understanding what is next for us when we find ourselves in a situation, whether we're ready for it or not. And I think now is the point when we have to learn to be ready for it whenever.
Absolutely. And I really do think it goes to show that you should be making your choices and developing your career plans from an internal perspective of what you want to do, what you find rewarding, and where you see opportunities, as opposed to what you think might be most stable and safe. Of course, that's a consideration, but like you, you know, I speak with clients all the time. Most recently, I had a client who was in the mortgage industry, and when that tanked, he freaked out. He decided to change careers, wanted to find something safe. He went into investment management, and he just got laid off again. And so, I mean, it wasn't something he was passionate about. He did it because he thought it was safe, and it wasn't. So I think, you know, obviously there are surprises out there that we can't predict, but if you're leading from your heart, I think, you know, you stand a much better chance of being successful, and you certainly have a much more satisfying career.
Pamela,
exactly.
We have another question from one of our listeners who wants to know if you had ever been downsized when you were in corporate America, and as a result, you know, what advice did you incorporate into your book for those who are really worried about being caught in the next layoff and would like to be proactive?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've been laid off. I've been downsized. And one of the things I said that inspired me to become a career coach and get involved in this is that I really feel like I've been through every type of work challenge that's out there in the corporate world, reorgs, downsizing, you know, bad bosses, good bosses, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I've definitely been laid off. And the first time I got laid off, it was during the dot-com crash, which was a terrible, terrible job market. And I know what it's like to be terrified and know that there aren't jobs out there and feel like you're, you know, you're out there on your own trying to find opportunities that don't exist. So, but I did. I found a great opportunity, and I think with patience, the people who are out there who are frustrated right now will also find their way. It's just during this kind of market, it takes a little bit longer, but there are definitely opportunities, and all things must change eventually. There's always going to be an uptick after a downtick, right?
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, Chris and I were actually working on building LasVegas.com right in the middle of the dot-com crash, and I had a consulting firm, and Chris ended up kind of staying behind to run the show as the president and CEO of LasVegas.com, and so we were both fortunate because we weren't in corporate America that at that point and having to look at being downsized. But I remember the first time I was let go, and I was, you know, I don't know, in my early 20s, and I was devastated because I thought I was just the most important thing to the company that I was with. Now, what I love at the beginning of your book, or actually, yeah, it's right after the introduction, is you've got a quiz of are you a corporate casualty? And that quiz actually isn't have you just been downsized. It's are you a corporate casualty within your corporation, right?
Yes. Yeah, have you been, are you a casualty because of staying in corporate America? Absolutely. And you know, the funny thing is it applies to other careers as well. I've had people who don't work in corporate America take I had someone in the nonprofit sector take the quiz and say, I'm a nonprofit casualty, so it may apply to other sectors too.
Well, one of the interesting things, you know, that really spurred me to get out of corporate America, and I've been out of corporate America since 1996, and didn't make a conscious choice to do that. Yes and no. I left corporate America to go with a small company that was being started up by some friends of mine, and, you know, 90 days later, there was no money for payroll. And, you know, I realize now how common that is. It is not unusual. And so what has happened over the years is watching people who are still in corporate America and trying to foster innovation where they are, trying to help reinvent entire industries such as the travel industry. And, you know, I found, you know, that even as a consultant to the travel industry, I couldn't get people off the dime to innovate. And so ended up starting my own technology company 2.5 years ago to get that done. And, you know, the industry is no more ready to accept it in purchasing that technology than to build it themselves. But at least now, you know, I've done what I set out to do. And so I got that innovation bug out of me. And, you know, and now I'm doing something that's more, you know, more of a service model, you know, than doing a huge investment. So as people are laying out their escape plan, and we're going to talk a lot more about this at 3 o'clock, about the personal aspects of your book, but how can they prepare financially? And you know, do you have to have a spouse that has a full-time job or some other form of income before you can step out?
Well, it definitely helps. I would have to say that. It definitely helps, but it's not necessarily the only way to do it. I have a wonderful husband, but, you know, we were definitely a dual-income couple. Living in New York City, you pretty much have to be unless you're very lucky. So I wasn't in that situation where I was able to quit and hope that I would start making money eventually. I had to pretty much hit the ground running and start making money right away. So I think it's really important to do your financial planning, especially if you're still in a corporate job and you're thinking about leaving and you have that income coming in, maybe hire a financial planner to work with you to figure out, you know, what are the scenarios, what are my options, figuring out the timing. Do I want to take a stepping stone job, for example? Some of the entrepreneurs that I speak with build a plan around the fact that they're not going to quit until a certain point where their small business starts to take off, and a lot of the escape artists that I interviewed did that very successfully. Others decide to make a jump to a perhaps less demanding job, a part-time job, or a consulting role where they still have some cash flow coming in, but they don't have to go to work all day, every day, and so they have more time for their side business or whatever they're preparing for the next chapter in their career.
And I saw you talk about strategic moonlighting, which I think is an interesting question of whether someone who's still in corporate America, you know, has that freedom and flexibility, or whether, you know, all bets are off because corporations are just axing people right and left without you know, giving them, you know, the normal kinds of tools and notice. Even senior people are getting laid off without any kind of outplacement service. So
yeah.
What do you say to that kind of ethical issue behind that, Pamela?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I stress when I talk about that in the book is that you have to be, I call it ethical moonlighting, because absolutely you might cause more problems than you solve if you break the rules of your organization and you get caught. So make sure you look at your employee manual, make sure that you're not doing something that could be an ethical problem, like using company resources in a way that's against the rules, or competing with your company by poaching clients or doing things like that. Those are bad things. They can help get you in trouble with your current company, and they can also ruin your reputation because, you know, you want to make sure that in your business and in your future career opportunities, you maintain that reputation for being ethical. So don't do anything that's going to have a bad impact on that. But at the same time, if you're following all the rules and you're not doing anything that's ethically questionable, and you really do want to make a leap, then I think it pays to make that time to start taking even baby steps, even if you only have time to make small baby steps in your spare time. But put together a plan to be spending a little bit of time at least on an ongoing basis moving forward to what you really want to do.
We had a great guest on last Thursday who talked about doing that in 10 minutes a day. She was our Thursday, actually the financial health slot, talking about how you achieve your goals and dreams. And, you know, taking it from that picture of the elephant of, oh, my God, you know, how can I get from where I am to where I want to be, but breaking that down into 10 minutes a day. So for those of you who want to go back and listen to that show, it was Thursday at, I believe it was 10:30 a.m. So let's just in the last few minutes we have here, and I'm so glad that we have another half an hour with you this afternoon. Let's talk a little bit, and we actually did have a question from one of the listeners about whether your quiz about being a corporate casualty is available online or just in your book.
It is available online, and if you go to my website, escapefromcorporate.com, you can find a link to it. And I can actually send you the direct link to the quiz as well if you'd like to post that on your website. They can go check
that out. That would be great. I'll do that in both the show blog and in the solutionslive.blogspot.com. And solutions is spelled with a C for those of you who are listening. So let's just talk really quickly about how people can get in touch with you if they're interested in talking to you about coaching.
Absolutely, yes. My website is, as I said, at escapefromcorporate.com, and there's a lot of information there about my coaching services and also my blog, and there's a free resource guide that you can access that has a lot of great resources for people who are contemplating career change, and it's also information about how to contact me by email if you want to talk about other ways that I can help you.
That's great, and I'll have those links on my site as well. So if you have just one piece of advice to give folks, you know, based on the best information that you heard in all of the different interviews that you did, what would that be?
Be proactive. Don't lay back and let your career just happen to you. You have to treat it like a business. Even if you're not an entrepreneur, you have to treat your career like it's a business. You have to make a business plan for your career, and you have to really take control, especially in this market. So don't let your career happen to you. Get out there and go after what you want.
Tiki, I have one more comment.
Okay.
Just something to say. I always go and research and see what Amazon says about our authors and their books as well. And I must say that all of the ratings and comments about Pamela's book are almost all 4.5 and 5 stars. There is absolutely nothing less than that about this book and the people that have read and purchased this book.
Well
that
is great
that.
To hear. So,
I think that's amazing and rare.
Well, and obviously it's available in the popular book sites, Amazon.com. There's actually, there'll be a link on my site also for the book for those of you who are perhaps driving and listening that way. And I just want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for today, TripSandbox.com, for those of you who need a getaway while you're figuring out your escape from corporate America. Pamela, thank you so much, and we look forward to reconnecting with you this afternoon at 3 o'clock.
Thank you. Me too. Can't wait to speak again.
Thank you, Pamela.
Thanks.
Terrific. All right, Chris. Well, that was very, very interesting. I mean, as I look through all of the different folks, like the woman from Mrs. Fields Cookies and the Build-A-Bear Workshop founders,
there's
just so much information. I mean, actually, Scott Adams was the funniest one to me because, you know, he went from corporate America, you know, had already been the creator of Dilbert, the cartoon strip, but now he owns this great cafe in Pleasanton, California, Stacy's Cafe. And so it would be really, really fun to talk to Scott and, you know, and hear about that. So perhaps we can collaborate with Pamela and see if we can't interview some of these corporate escape artists together. That would be a lot of fun.
Oh, that's what I was just going to say. I mean, that would be wonderful for her to bring them all back and see what more advice they have, what they think specifically about this current economy, what they might
Definitely.
Do a little differently if they were to do it again. All of those are wonderful things.
Right. And, you know, I mean, this is a fairly recent book, but you're right. Even if it was written in the first quarter, everything
changed. Oh, exactly. Everything's changed since October of, you know, September, October of last year. So,
right.
Yeah. It's funny, on Amazon.com, a number of people commented about the yellow cover and the spine and how it popped out at them, and they're so happy they found it.
No kidding.
Belt.
And, you know, I've heard that red is one of those colors that makes that happen. And Susan Steinbrecher, our next author, used the red color scheme on her book, and a really, really peaceful, actually it looks like a pencil diagram with a heart on the front, which I love.
I see that. Yes.
Don't see her on the switchboard yet. So, again, let me just thank our sponsor, TripSandbox.com. For those of you who would like to plan a holiday and know all of the costs before you go, I will tell you that cruising is one of Michael and my favorite things to do. We try to go on a cruise at least a couple of times a year. It's been a little tough, you know, in this last entrepreneurial phase we've just gone through. But anyway... So, Chris, what's going on in Dallas today? Is it a beautiful day?
It's a beautiful day. It's very windy. It's been chilly, but the sun is always out. So you're cold and chilly, then you get in your car and you're, like, burning up because it's like a little sauna inside your car. But that's a very typical winter day in Dallas, Texas, don't you think?
Absolutely.
You know it well, but I think
do.
You like Tampa better. What's
I
the,
like
that?
Tampa a lot better because I'm looking out at palm trees, and Michael and I are blessed to live on a marina, and I'm watching a little duck swim around the boats. So it doesn't get much better than that.
Oh, how cute is that?
Yeah. Well, speaking of Dallas, Texas, our next guest is teed up, and let's get her on the phone. And she is actually, looks like, from the Fort Worth side of things. Hang on one second here.
Oh, love Fort Worth.
Susan, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Great, great. And are you from Fort Worth? Or
well,
you,
actually, it's considered mid-cities.
Ah.
It's in the Metroplex, but I'm smack in the middle of Dallas-Fort Worth, about 10 minutes from DFW Airport.
Well, I bought a house in 1983 in Euless, Texas, when it was all fields, and I was back recently driving through wishing I had bought some of the real estate in those fields, because now
right.
every square inch of Euless is built upon.
That is correct, and we are right next to the Euless area in Hearst.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
ATV area.
Live there.
My husband and I got married in the Methodist Church in Hearst.
Wow. Small world.
It is a very small world. And, hey, I am so sorry we missed you when I was in Dallas last week. I will not let that happen again.
Oh, no problem. I just remembered something coming up, and I wanted to attend, so next time.
Absolutely. Well, Chris is the head of our executive girlfriends group in Dallas, Texas, and we get all of the executive women of the travel industry together, but always love to have your kind of input and involvement. So that will be terrific. Well, Susan, you have written a really interesting book. And in the introduction for the show at the beginning, Chris and I were talking about how she and I have both been, I will say, victims of command and control style leadership, you know, over in many different shapes and sizes, and the names shall be held back to protect the innocent, or perhaps the guilty. But you've written a book called Heart-Centered Leadership, and I love the tagline, which says, an invitation to lead from the inside out. Tell us what got you to the place where you wanted to write a book, and how you and Joel Bennett, who is also a PhD, got together.
Good question. How did I get to this book? I think, honestly, through my own experience and managing hundreds of people throughout my career in the hotel industry, and just seeing what worked and what didn't work for me personally as I kind of grew up through the industry. In addition to that, when I started my firm 17 years ago, we specialize in leadership development and executive coaching, and I started noticing patterns of success and lack of success, if you will. So when we would coach somebody, sometimes it's because they were the star performer and the organization was smart enough to invest in them to kick it up another notch, if you will. And then other times we work with executives that are beginning to derail. And the one thing I found that was absolutely the number one reason for derailment in a leader was their lack of interpersonal skills and their lack of ability to really connect with their employees or their associates and build a team and inspire and move that team forward. So when I started when I thought about my own experiences when I was successful and when I wasn't, and when I saw what was happening with my clients, I really felt like, gosh, you know, we're making this so much more difficult than it needs to be. It gets down to some very, very core, basic human element items, if you will. It's about relationship. It's about connection. It's about valuing people at the end of the day. And we know all the research backs all that up as well, but I certainly found that just in my own experience working, my own experience in the industry and also working with clients. Now, I partnered with Dr. Bennett because I knew that to put out a message called heart-centered leadership was going to be controversial. And because most people definitely come from the command and control aspect of management, if you will, and so I really wanted to partner with someone that was on the academic side of the world because I came from the business side, although I had my own degrees and everything else, but I really wanted to partner with someone who specialized and did his dissertation in leadership and get his perspective. And really, the two of us just came beautifully together. We had a very much shared mindset about what good leadership was and what it wasn't. And that's how we kind of came together. I saw him speak at a conference and thought, wow, he's not only got great information, he's a great speaker, and he's a writer, and he's written several books. And so that's how we ended up collaborating.
Well, you know, one of my favorite things is actually from the introduction of your book, where you talk about the fact that the metaphor or image of the heart is often associated with softness,
right,
yielding, kindness, and perhaps even weakness. But you say that the heart is also strong and powerful and the driving force of life, the vibrant center of circulation. And I don't know if that came from Joel or from you, but it really created a really powerful picture.
Right. I mean, we think exactly. We think of the heart as being this soft thing, but exactly what you just said is it's one of the most powerful organs, and we're finding more and more and more about just what it takes to be healthy and how much, when literally we're finding that when someone says that person broke your heart, they're not kidding. I mean,
mm-hmm.
The connection between health. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to delve into that whole piece around leadership. We didn't want to just, you know, write any leadership book. What was really important to us was to deal with that leader, I'll call holistically, mind, body, and spirit, because that whole human being shows up at work and impacts people's lives and impacts the success or lack of success of that business. So there was all kinds of ripple effect, if you will, from who that person is and how they show up. And one of our principles is called care for the heart, and that's one of the more distinguishable pieces from some of the other principles. But the reality is we started to see a connection between not only what was happening in terms of empowering or engagement of this kind of a leader, a heart-centered leader, but we also saw the correlation between the actual health of that leader and their style. And we go into a lot of that under that seventh principle called care for the heart, where there is a direct impact in terms of how that person, again, shows up as a leader, and not only the health of that leader, but the health of people around them. Some pretty profound information coming out around that. But so I think that's one of the reasons why we wanted to bring this forward, is because we think of leadership being this business thing in a vacuum. The reality is we're impacting people more than we know.
Hmm.
It's very, very powerful stuff, Susan.
Yeah.
I mean, right now everybody's talking about authenticity and leadership,
right.
Transparency and leadership,
mm-hmm.
Openness. They're comparing the old model of Chainsaw Al, if you will, right,
yes. mm-hmm.
to a leader like Anne Mulcahy at Xerox.
Right.
And I think you do. That's exactly what you're speaking about
exactly.
here.
Exactly. Exactly. That whole authentic dialogue and conversation. I mean, listen, let's just be honest. You know, when a business is having challenges in today's economic environment, there's many having challenges. And in fact, this is why we're speaking so much out right now, because so many will think that, well, gosh, you know, I can't share with my employees where we really are as a company, and I can't really talk about the fact that, you know, our business is down. Well, the reality is I think employees know that. I mean, they sense what's going on in the business. They know when the phones aren't ringing as much. They know when the inquiries from the web aren't coming as frequently. They know it anyway. So if you don't sit down and actually have that conversation and dialogue around, here's where we are, here's where we're aspiring to be, here's where we need your help to get there, here's our vision, and actually have a plan and have a vision and provide hope. That providing hope is really critical, because they're looking for that person. In fact, that's one of our principles called Know Your Impact. It's like that leader is the goldfish swimming around in the fishbowl. And leaders often forget that fishbowl is glass. Therefore, it is transparent and translucent, and people are looking through the glass, if you will, and observing, you know, using that metaphor of the fish in the fishbowl, observing that leader who's the fish swimming around minding their own business, but they're forgetting they're always on stage. People are watching what they do, what they don't do, what they say, what they don't say, and like it or not, making decisions about that leader and about the health of that company as a result. Tough position to be in, because we're all human beings as leaders. The reality is it's an awesome responsibility we sign up for, and we have to be very mindful of the fact that we have that impact. And so if we sit down and have authentic conversations with our employees and saying, you know, here's where our goals are, here's the actual reality of where we are, what ideas do you have? You talk to the customer, you hear from the customer, what are they saying? And tap into all of the wealth of knowledge sitting right there underneath our feet, so to speak, that we miss. And we think the executive board or the leadership team of a company has to, you know, close the door and be in this room and create everything themselves. Sure, you need to be doing some of that, but imagine the power of having roundtable discussions with employees to say, you know, what do you see? What do you think would be, if you were running this company, what would be the top three things you would do? And I think leaders would be absolutely shocked at the wisdom that would come forward when they had those kind of authentic conversations.
And Susan, why doesn't it come out that there are still people who are living in the old command and control style? You make a point in your book when you talk about retention that associates rarely quit a company. They
yes.
quit their boss.
They quit their boss. That's exactly
and,
right.
And so does HR just not care?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think a lot of times HR does care, and I think sometimes, in some cases, HR is the one trying to wave the wand to the operations folks about, wait a minute, you know, people are really critical here in making sure that we achieve those business objectives. Yeah, we have to achieve the business objectives, but it's how do we do it? What we know is that if you take really good care of your employees, they will take good care of the customers, because you're modeling that. They see how you're treating them, and they will in turn treat their customers that way, which will in turn take care of your profitability. You know, it's the old Harvard Reviews work, the service profit chain. One sort of leads to the other. And that's been proven over and over again by research and by documents. You know, that chain of events is what creates the most success. And I think sometimes, one, managers fall back on what they've always known, haven't been taught something differently, or they feel that by putting more power and more pressure on, that'll get people to jump. Yes, there's some argument that it will cause people to jump in the short term, but then you really run the risk of burnout in the long term. And if we're constantly at them with well, you need to do more and more and more and more and more. After a while, they begin to discern, you know, what's really important, what's not, and it's kind of the cry wolf syndrome, and they're not going to rise to the occasion for every event anyway. Whereas if you say, these are the top three most critical areas, and we're going to focus on these three and these three only for now, what can we do from your perspective to help us achieve those three? What do you need from us? This is what we need from you. So I think it's a matter of old habits and not really learning a different behavior, and I think it's a matter of not trusting that by letting go literally a little bit and actually engaging and empowering people to rise to the surface, they're more motivated to work their best for you. And if they're more motivated to work their best for you, chances are their productivity and their output's going to be greater. And so I think it's a combination of that.
Susan, whenever I see this, what I see is that often the actual hiring process in the beginning of how to hire for your leaders
mm-hmm.
is still old, even
yes.
though all of the studies that you just mentioned are out there.
Yeah.
So how is it that we can actually change the hiring process, whether it's the board of directors or the senior leadership in a company, to bring this into the equation as they're choosing who's going to run their businesses?
Right. I think one of the things I'm a huge proponent of is starting with, not to get overly analytical, but you've got to start with the right foundation. And as you know, you build a house upon a poor foundation, the house is going to crumble. The foundation is to really understand what is needed in the position, the skills, the ability, the knowledge, and the motivation that is required for that person to fit the profile that you're looking for in that company, right? So it's looking for skills, ability, and knowledge, motivation, and cultural fit, if you will. So if we're looking to move more into, let's say, the heart-centered leader space, then what does it take to be a heart-centered leader and identifying what those competencies and characteristics are. So you're identifying the characteristics and competencies, you're identifying the skills, ability, knowledge, and motivation, and then from that foundation, you begin to build your questions. The type of questions that I know we teach all of our clients to use when we design, because we do a lot of custom design leadership development training, among many topics from interviewing to how to conduct the inspiring performance appraisal, goal setting, stress management, et cetera. But when we teach the interviewing, we always say start with that foundation, and then the types of questions that you want to ask predominantly in the interview, beyond some of the, you know, check the resume questions, but the majority of the time should be spent around what we call performance-based questions or behavior-based questions. And it's actually asking that applicant to literally go back in time and pick particular events that they have actually gone through and experienced. So, for example, let's say customer service is important. What do you think is going to happen if you ask somebody, well, tell me how you would handle a difficult customer? Well, they're going to tell you what they think you want to hear, right? I mean, they're going to tell you, oh, you know, customers always ride, and I always, you know, it's empathetic to the customer, whatever. So in other words, you're not really going to get the real truth about how that person honestly deals with customers and have dealt with customers day in and day out. But instead, if you ask a question, pick the toughest customer you ever had. Go back in your memory, and I want you to actually pick a particular person who comes to your mind, because if it's a really tough customer, that person probably never will forget that person. So you say, tell me the toughest customer you ever dealt with. I want you to literally go back in your memory bank and run the movie for me. Walk me through exactly what the scene was. What did the person say? What did you say back? What was the situation and what was the end result? What that does is it literally puts that person back in time. And there's, you know, there's some ways to coach to make sure that we get them there. We make sure that they stay grounded into that past event. But by having them come up and retell the story, you can tell if their own body language and how they're reacting as they're telling it, if they're really there or not. And when they're telling the story, you're hearing all the stuff that's going to give you the best predictor. And what we know, Our best predictor of future performance is past performance. So you're going to get your all this data from this person, and then you can make the assessment whether they are a match or not a match to what you're looking for in the culture. But you really have to put them in that experience. So that's one way to do that. You can also go through simulations and other things. But that type of interviewing helps you really identify who that person really is and how they're showing up. I have found that style to work like an incredibly well and truly understanding who the person is, to the point when I finish, they'll say, wow, I've never been interviewed quite like this, and I revealed probably more than I should have. And I'm
absolutely.
Like, hey, no one's perfect, but, you know, I need to know who they are.
Right. So one of the things, as you've been talking, has been reminding me of another interview that Chickie and I did last week with a woman who wrote a book called The Art of the Apology, and how having a pro-apology culture is very important, which I think is an element probably of heart-driven leadership.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that drove us to talking about the current situation with the collapse of the mortgages and things like that. And it strikes me that if some of these mortgage companies or banks had heart-driven leadership, we wouldn't have been doing all of this trading and maybe find ourselves in this situation. And do you have a comment about that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think, listen, business as usual is just dead. I mean, you know, all the old way of, you know, about greed and about, you know, making decisions at all cost of, you know, to the impact on, you know, the environment, to the impact on people, to the impact on the stakeholders, the impact on the stockholders, the impact. I mean, we have just gotten so out of balance that it is coming, unfortunately, tumbling down all at the same point. And when you really get down to it, it's because we've lost sort of the soul of human to human. And it's about, you know, higher margins. And I get it that Wall Street starts to demanding that. Well, why are they demanding that? Because they've had experience being able to have that. Well, now I want more of that. And then instead of having a long-term focus on, well, wait a minute, these are things that have to be done in order to build this business in a long-term sustainable format. It's, you know, managing to the current P&L or month-to-month P&L or quarterly P&L. You know, everybody knows intuitively. If you really, really ask people to honestly assess intuitively, did they not know that they were going down the wrong path? If they were honest, they'd say, no, I knew that.
Yeah, exactly.
I really knew that. No, then they got themselves caught.
Right. And they didn't know when to stop, and they didn't know how to bring it up and when to apologize, because the environment doesn't promote and support
exactly
that behavior.
Right. That's right. Well, at least it doesn't in the short term, but it does in the long term. I will tell you, those companies that are not hurting today are ones that stayed the course, or ones that said, yeah, I hear you, but you know what? That doesn't make any sense. That's not a good business model.
We need to find ways to celebrate those companies.
Right.
And those cultures.
Yeah. Totally agree with that. And I think it would be a great case study instead of constant bombardment of all the things that are doom and gloom and wrong. Wouldn't it be fabulous if it was in the press of let's look at the top 10 companies out there that have got it right.
Inside these collapsing industries.
Yes,
right.
in those industries, because they're out there. They're out there.
Well, it's interesting, Susan, because we just talked to Pamela Skillings, who wrote Escape from Corporate America, about doing a show. Her book actually was a collaboration of all of the different interviews she did with what she calls corporate escape artists. And so we're musing about how great it would be to do a show with her to interview a lot of these folks. And so maybe we ought to look at that with you, of taking celebrating the heart-centered leadership. Susan, can you just give us a couple of practical examples of the difference between the old-style leadership that we all know and don't love, and what it actually practically means to be a heart-centered leader?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I would say, if I were to define, you know, I look at things like there's management, there's leadership, and then there's heart-centered leadership. And the reality is all of those pieces at certain levels are needed in a business to a certain degree. But again, as we've already shared, you know, reverting back to everything falls under the management is what has gotten into a lot of trouble. So I would find, you know, management is just, you know, it's the process of working through others to achieve objectives, right? It entails effective and efficient use of limited resources. You think about the planning, organizing, directing, control model that we all learned in school. Leadership is more about the ability to make things happen by encouraging and inspiring people and acting as a sort of catalyst for change. Again, very important, nice situation, helpful in business today. The heart-centered leader takes that foundation of good leadership and moves it up one more level. And now you're getting into things like having the wisdom and the courage and compassion to really lead others authentically and transparently and having that humility and service to others. That's a whole nother level built upon good, solid leadership abilities. So when you think about, for example, let's just say approach to problems. A manager's approach to problem is typically very scientific and very analytical and very tactical. Leadership might come from an approach to a problem with maybe fewer explicit tools. It's a little bit more intuition is coming into place. Heart-centered leadership is going to use a lot of wisdom and a lot of intuition on top of the facts provided in order to make the best decision. It's not going to be strictly, what does the numbers lead up to be, because unfortunately people are not just numbers. And so you have to have an intuitiveness and a wisdom to understand the marketplace and what's going on around us, what's the pulse, what's the trends telling us. So some of it is factual and a lot of it is just wisdom and intuition and other tools built upon that hard data, if you will. So that's just a quick example of those three levels and how that might show up when you're, let's say, just dealing with an approach to a problem.
And Susan, I understand you have a new book coming out called Roadmap to Success.
Yeah,
can you tell us just a little bit about that and when
absolutely.
It's going to be out?
Absolutely. That book actually came out in October, and it's a book collaboration with really 15 other authors, including Covey, Stephen Covey and Ken Blanchard. And when I was approached about the book, they asked me to write about what have you found to be your keys to success. And what I chose to write in my chapter instead about was what I noticed from my most successful clients, what I noticed were some incredible patterns of behavior. And so in that chapter, I'm identifying five core fundamentals that I noticed, although all of them had their own set of competencies and strengths and all of that, what I could not help but notice and was very striking is that all of them had the same five core fundamentals, and I speak about that in that chapter of that book called Roadmaps to Success.
Great. Susan, in the last minute here that we have available, can you please provide us with your website address so listeners can learn
absolutely.
More about your books and about
absolutely.
Your consulting services?
Thank you so much. Yes, if you go to Institute of HCL, which is just Heart Centered Leadership for short, HCL.com, Institute of HCL.com. You'll find out about the Heart Center Leadership book there, as well as Roadmap to Success, and that's where we talk. We do workshops around Heart Center Leadership and roadmaps, et cetera, and all that information is provided there.
Okay, terrific. Well, it has been wonderful, and I am hoping that you and Chris, since you're both in the Dallas area, can find a time to get together for coffee. And,
absolutely. We'd
love
that.
The next time our
Chris.
Executive Girlfriends group gets together, that would be absolutely terrific, and I would love to have you on the Executive Girlfriends group call to talk about this.
Yes, would love that very much. Thank you so much to both of you for the opportunity and spending time together today.
Thank
well,
you.
Well, it has been terrific.
All right. Thank you, ladies.
Okay. Take care. Have a
take
great
care.
Day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, Chris, that was very interesting, and I thought it was especially interesting that you brought up the whole point of the whole issue of being authentic, because, as you know, our next guest, one of his last books was a book on authenticity and what consumers require, and I think it's really not all that different
from what employees require in the workplace as well, and that leaders do have to be authentic. So I want to just take a quick commercial break to talk about our sponsor today, TripSandbox.com. And if you have been living under command and control leadership and need a break, go to TripSandbox.com. Lots of special deals these days. Either fortunately or unfortunately, the travel industry is hurting pretty substantially, and one of the best ways to vote your wallet is to take a trip. Great economic stimulus and just amazing deals right now, particularly on cruises and weekend getaways where you can often get the last rooms that are available at a terrific price. Okay, well, let's shift gears a little bit. Back by popular demand is our next guest, Joe Pine. And Joe is an expert on a lot of things. He questioned me saying that he was an expert on branding, but that's my own observation about him as opposed to how he positions himself. Welcome, Joe.
Well, thank you, Chickie. I appreciate it.
I have on with me today my co-host, Chris Bradshaw. She's in Dallas, Texas.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Wonderful, thank you. And I am thrilled to talk about authenticity.
And Joe, we had decided on a topic of get real or get lost, which I love. And, you know, that has to do with both authenticity and how you position your brand for growth. And I know, you know, growth hasn't been, high on the list of topics the last couple of months because everybody's just, fretting about decline. Tell us what you've been thinking about since we last talked.
Well, I do think that that in a time of recession and a time of decline for most companies, as you're saying, it does. I would say you don't want to hunker down and just keep doing the same things you've been doing, only by trying to get rid of people.
Right.
Instead, you do need to think about growth. You do need to reevaluate the business. You do need to prepare for that upturn, which inevitably comes as well, and not get caught unawares by it. And I think the ideas that my co-author Jim Gilmore and I talk about in our books are key ways of doing that.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself for those who aren't familiar with your various books, and tell us a little bit about the consulting that you guys do as well.
Well, we often joke that we should have called our company Frameworks R Us, because that's what we do, is that we observe what's going on in the world, and then we develop frameworks that make sense of it, and then be able to explain it to other people, saying, see, this is what's happening, even though you don't really see it. You know, we're not futurists to tell you what's going to happen. We're telling you what's happening right now, but in ways that perhaps you haven't noticed yet. And then those frameworks help provide prescriptions for what, therefore, you should do about it. So we sort of specialize in helping executives see the world differently, as the back of our business card puts it.
I like that.
We did it first with mass customization, where we talked about how it's not good enough anymore just to mass produce the same thing for everybody, but you need to differentiate your offerings by providing everybody with exactly what they want at a price they're willing to pay. So you serve those co-equal imperatives of both mass, high cost, or high volume, and then customization of individually getting down to individual want and need. And then we did it again with the experience economy that talked about how goods and services are everywhere being commoditized, and what consumers are looking for are experiences, memorable events that engage them in an inherently personal way. And you can see that happening all over the place now. Where if you provide just a mere good, a manufactured good, if you provide a mundane service, then it's very hard to differentiate yourself, that everybody else is doing the same sorts of things. And you've got to go outside of that to really engage people and create that experience. And that, of course, then led us into authenticity, because we realized that whenever experiences come to the fore, issues of authenticity follow closely behind. And increasingly, people don't want the fake from the phony. They want the real from the genuine. So really the number one business imperative for companies today is, in fact, to render their offerings to be perceived as authentic. And if they're not perceived as authentic, then they have very little chance for growth.
Chris,
you jump right in.
Well, you know, I would ask this question. You know, used to be before if authenticity is the thing, then when it wasn't, I didn't mind picking up a knockoff Dior handbag, right? But now, if authenticity is key, then I am willing to, instead of paying the same amount of money that I would to pick up a knockoff, I'm willing to rent the bag.
Right, which actually is interesting. It really turns it into more of an experience because now you're basically time sharing it, and you know you're paying for the experience of wearing it as opposed to actually owning it. And
exactly.
That's something that I think will increasingly happen. Well, you know, any consumer good that's durable, I think is possible to be time shared in that same way. You know, not just jets, but cars and handbags and gowns and computers and who knows what else.
Right, and movies and all those things. Everything because of our demand for real-time gratification and the fact that we want that experience. And I may only want that experience for a week.
Right.
As opposed to a lifetime of paying $1,000 for the Birkin. And back to you, Chickie.
Well, what I was going to talk about is this whole issue of being what you say you are, which is actually one of the chapters in authenticity. And I think that that really speaks to the whole issue of branding. But
exactly.
Before you're ready to do that branding, you know, the previous chapter in the book is deconstructing authenticity. So what is the biggest situation you can remember where somebody called you guys in, and you don't necessarily have to talk about them by name, but where you came in and the whole experience was either fake or just inauthentic, not what it said it was going to be, and how did that turn around?
Well, I've encountered that more where companies that we've worked with were bought by somebody. that then made it inauthentic because they changed it around. You know a great entrepreneurial company that had a really focus on doing it and doing it real became phony as they started to change things behind the scenes and make it not as just not the same anymore. And you know you can see that. Yeah, it is an issue in sort of any time some company gets bought, because what may have been true to self for an entrepreneurial company may no longer be true to self for the purchasing company.
And the purchasing company tries to still present as if,
right.
But when the foundational values are not there.
Right. Well, think about, for example, Ben and Jerry's.
Yeah.
You know, to use a classic example that people know about. You know, Ben and Jerry's was this wonderful little eclectic ice cream manufacturer. You know, with all the hippie heritage that it had and everything, giving to the rainforest and saving the environment and that. And then it got bought by a big, huge company. If I recall correctly, it was Unilever. And that changed things. It changed people's perception of it. And with authenticity, perception is all important because it is how they perceive your offerings and, by extension, the places in which they're offered and your company. And immediately people perceive this as, okay, the guys are selling out. You know, that's the phrase that describes the height of inauthenticity.
Yep.
By selling out to a big faceless corporation. And even before that corporation had even a chance to do anything bad, you know, there were some people that had already given up on the brand. But then over time, you do get those inevitable effects that happen. And for many people, not everyone certainly, but for many people, it's not the same as it was when they were by themselves. You know, on the other hand, I'll give you an example of a place where it worked wonderfully well, and that is Disney buying Pixar. You know, because I think Pixar had more of the Walt Disney DNA than Disney itself did.
Yes.
You know, and they brought that back in. They, you know, John Lasseter, the head guy at Pixar, was viewed as a modern day Walt Disney. He had worked at Disney doing animations several decades ago and got fired, and you know, went on to various things and on to Pixar. And it's just, I think Bob Iger just made a brilliant move in purchasing that and basically turning over all of their own animation to them, rather than try and incorporate them into the you know, the Disney, the way Disney was doing animation at that time.
Joe, I'd like to turn the focus just a little bit, same subject, but you say early on in the authenticity book that nothing kills authenticity like ubiquity. And Chris and I have both spent the better part of our adult lives in the travel industry, travel and hospitality. And, you know, we have seen, you know, airlines go bankrupt, and then, you know, moments later, they're redoing their fleet and their branding. We see hotel companies who are struggling to make it try to maintain 10 and 12 and 14 brands under the parent company. What do you have to say about that kind of situation on branding? Because, you know, it doesn't seem very authentic to me.
No, and you know, there, you know, if you're going belly up, so to speak, which is probably a term you ought not to use with airlines. that's you know, sorry about that. It's probably not the right time to immediately come out with new branding and with new positioning and with new marketing taglines. You sort of have to go through a period of penance.
Apologize.
Right, exactly. You do have to apologize. You know, that alone is such a key thing, is I think corporations, you know, must go through this HR class where they're told never in any circumstances apologize. But that is just one of the key things that can make you human with somebody. You know, and to point out the trend by the counter trend, you know, Southwest Airlines has a chief apology officer. There is somebody there. Yes, his job is to look into anything that ever goes wrong at Southwest and personally write an apology to each individual person that was impacted by it. And that, you know, why don't more people do that?
Oh, how huge is that? That the value, the revenue, the lack of lost revenue associated
right.
with that.
Right. You know, I think so many people, our companies, are afraid that an apology is an admission of guilt in a court of law, and it just gets in the way of them being human, of them being authentic to their customers.
Well, and not being commoditized. All of a sudden, that kind of service and personal touch actually does make a difference.
Right. Exactly. It is a key way out of the commoditization trap, because you have a human face. You're shown to be different than everybody else. You know, think about Jeff Blue, and it's Valentine's Day Massacre.
Right.
You know, where they were thought to be a different airline, that they were authentic relative to the faceless airlines that were out there. But then when they left people on the tarmac for 7 hours, people, you know, changed their opinion, say, hey, this is not the same. You know, or it is the same as every other airline. That's not what they said they were. To get back to your point about to be perceived authentic, one of the key branding elements is to be what you say you are. And that's what companies have to do. In all the different ways that they represent themselves, that representation has to match reality, or people are going to perceive them as phony.
Well, and I know a lot of folks who aren't deeply involved in marketing, and in both strategic marketing and tactical marketing, think of a brand as simply a logo. What are the elements of a company's character and brand that you evaluate when you try to determine if they are, in fact, being authentic?
Well, I think in terms of being what you say you are, and it's one of the two key standards that we've identified in the book Authenticity, the other one being True to Self. And where true to self is a self-directed task, where you're looking at the internal consistency that you have, and does the product hang together, does it match who's offering it, and so forth. Being what you say you are is very much other-focused. It is looking at how you represent yourself to others. And I do think there are five key elements that we've identified. One is your assigned names. It's who you call yourself. You know, what's the name of the company? What's the name of the offering of sub-brands and so forth? And there are ways to do naming that implies authenticity, such as having a founder's name, where you can tie it to an actual real live human being. And there are ways to do it in inauthentic manner, such as, you know, coming up with this made-up Latin, Greek concatenation word that people know that is not real.
Actually, it's so funny that you mentioned that, Joe, because yesterday or day before yesterday, I was looking on Twitter at who I might want to connect to and saw Dan Bricklin. And back in the 80s, I used Dan Bricklin demo to create my first mock-up of an application. And I had no idea that there was a real Dan Bricklin behind it. And he sent me a note on Twitter last night. He said, yes, unlike Betty Crocker, Dan Bricklin is a real person.
Right.
And I thought how funny that is.
Or Tommy Bahama.
Again, I didn't realize that Betty Crocker wasn't a real person. You know, silly me, and I actually lived through those days.
Yes, Virginia, there is a Dan Bricklin. So the second key element is your express statements. It's what you articulate you are. So this is what you say about yourself in your advertising, in your messaging, in your 401k and annual reports, in any communique where you're using text to describe what you are. And that's often the easiest way to be perceived as phony, is to advertise things that you are not. And companies do that all the time. I mean, think about the ad for an airline or a hotel. If you could check into the ad, you'd have a great experience. But when you get to the actual place, and that disconnect between what they say about themselves in the ad and what you actually encounter gets them perceived as phony. And that brings us to what I think is probably the most key one, is established places. That's where and when you're encountered. It's the places in which you're offering and what they look like, what they feel like, where they are. Jim and I think that we've got a whole chapter in the book on that, but the key aspect of marketing and branding is to move from advertising to placemaking. And placemaking is where you create places, whether they're in the real world or in the virtual world, but create places where people can experience who you are. Then there can be no disconnect between what you say about yourself and what people encounter, because they become one and the same thing. And that's why you see so many companies, so many manufacturers like American Girl with their American Girl places and their boutique and bistros, or Apple with its Apple stores, and even service companies. My favorite example there is ING Direct, you know, an internet-based bank that opens up cafes. And then their website for the cafes, I don't think they still have it up there now, but their original words where they use is, come to our cafe to experience who we are. And that's exactly what companies need to do.
Wow. Well, I want to come back to that, but I want to remind those who are listening that if you have questions for Joe, please go to the blogtalkradio.com/solutionslive site. There's a chat button in the center of the screen, and if you'd like to ask a question, I will be happy to pass that on, or you can also call into the show, and that guest call-in number is 646-727-2840. And I also want to thank once again our sponsor for today, TripSandbox.com. Joe, it's interesting that you talk about creating that place and creating that experience of what a company is. I was looking through your book, Authenticity, and one thing jumped out at me about our ability to manufacture fraud now exceeds our ability to detect it. And I'm not sure whether you said that or someone else said
that's too nice a set of words. I think we quoted somebody saying that.
Right. Well, it was actually talking about the movie Simone, where, you know, you had the computer-generated cyber actress. You know, if you take a look at, and a great example of this is CEO blogs and CEOs or people who have allowed their name to be used on Twitter in dialogues where it's someone else who's been hired to be them. And I can't think of anything more inauthentic than that.
Right, right. Well, you remind me of the fact that, you know, it seems like every time we write a book, it takes twice as long as the previous book. And authenticity being such an amorphous topic, it really took us a long time to get our arms around it and really get down and write it. And we had people suggest, well, you should get a ghostwriter. You know.
Oh, no.
Well, yeah,
now, that's funny.
Right, exactly.
That
you know, but
funny.
But people do that all the time as well. It's the same sort of thing. You know, is hire somebody to put words in your mouth. And no, it's not really authentic. There probably is a time and a place for it, but not when you're writing a book called Authenticity.
Right. And I love, actually, at the end of chapter number 3, it says, if you are authentic, then you don't have to say you're authentic.
Right.
And if you say you're authentic, you better be authentic, and it's easier to be authentic if you don't say you're authentic. Seems like a bit of a circular argument there, but it really is true.
Yeah, well, and that's a mistake that marketers make all the time. I mean, they obviously detect this thirst for authenticity, because you see them plastering the words authentic or real all over their packaging or in their advertisement. But all that does, in my mind, is put a bullseye on their back. That, you know, when you go out proclaiming yourself to be real, well, then people are going to start looking for anything that trips you up and shows you, in fact, to not be that. And it's better not to say you're authentic. Don't use authentic or real in your advertising, in your packaging or anything. Just figure out how to render yourself as authentic.
So what about the CEO blogs? What do you think about that? Is
well,
that helping?
I think if they're really writing it, you know, the most famous person, of course, is Jonathan Schwartz at Sun. You know, if it's something that they are doing themselves, that I think it can be a tremendous positive for the company. It lets the company be perceived not as faceless. You know, it does put a face on it. Here's a real person. He's at the head of this company. Here's what he thinks, and here's how he goes about his daily life and about his business, and all those sorts of things are tremendous ways to render that company as authentic.
So, if you can boil it down into a couple of things that you would tell not only large companies, but a lot of the small companies who are popping up now. We were just talking, actually, in the first show, we were interviewing the author of Escape from Corporate America and talking about creating the career of your dreams. And a lot of folks, after being laid off, are now trying to decide, you know, whether they're going to form a company. You know, what's the top advice you give them about branding and authenticity?
Well, it's what we've been echoing all along, and that is to understand what you say about yourselves and how does that, in fact, match reality. And I think companies ought to rigorously examine all of the ways that they say themselves, that they represent themselves. You know, we talked about assigned names and express statements and established places. The other two are your declared motivations, why you say you are in business. You know, what is that purpose that you uphold out there? And your displayed appearances, about how you show what you are, you know, all the physical things that you have, how your places look, or the look and feel of it and so forth. And basically do an audit of all those things and just find all the different ways that you represent yourself and start to examine, well, which ones are really true and which ones are not. And eliminate those things that do not match reality, that exaggerate the truth or even take it off in, you know, completely other directions. And only then can you really be sure that you're doing the right things in your branding to not be perceived as phony.
And so how does brand actually tie back to growth? And presuming that growth means not only top-line revenue growth, but bottom line growth as well in profitability. How do those two things work hand in hand?
Well, what you want to do is generate demand for your offerings, and so that people want your offerings versus somebody else's. And if they perceive you as the real thing, as genuine, and your competitors as not, then the chances are going to buy you are going to go up. The chances you're going to be able to charge a premium for that are going to go up. I mean, look, the phrase that you love so much, Chickie, that you mentioned at the beginning about ubiquity is the death knell of authenticity. That, in fact, was said in reference to one of our great brands over the past two decades, Starbucks, which now has a growth problem. They were a tremendous growth engine when people viewed them as authentic. But as they became ubiquitous, as they became everywhere, it became much more difficult for them to render that for as many people as they could in the past. And therefore, people started perceiving them as inauthentic, perceiving them as a big corporation, perceiving them as putting mom-and-pop shops out of business, you know, sort of the Walmart of its industry. And all of that put the stopped the gears in its growth engine. And that's what Starbucks is going to have to get that back in order to continue to grow again.
Is that the same issue that Krispy Kreme had?
I think Krispy Kreme had some financial issues as well. But it is an interesting thing because when they were viewed as a regional brand, you know, from the Southeast, they also, you know, were viewed as very authentic. If you happened to come across them, if you happened to be in an area where they provided, then it was like, wow, this is really great.
Yeah, take advantage, yeah.
Right, take advantage because you don't know when your chance is going to come up again.
Exactly.
You know, but yes, as they expand across the country and become everywhere, then they lose that specialness. They lose that distinctiveness. They also lose that rootedness, you know, where you view them rooted in the ground. In a certain place. You know, I think of other brands like that, like a Waffle House. You know, I was in December, I was in Arizona and was shocked to see a Waffle House there. And I went, what's a Waffle House doing in Arizona? You know, that belongs in the Southeast.
Right.
And so you get that effect. Obviously, you want to be able to, I mean, you're going to get to that point where in order to grow, you need to go to grow out of your locale. But you need to do that, think about that very hard, and think about how to do that while maintaining that rootedness that made you perceived as authentic in the first place.
Got it. Well, Joe, in the 5 minutes that we have left, let me just ask you a couple of things. One, are you working on a new book?
Yes, actually, I am. I've been working hard this month in particular. On a new set of ideas, a new framework for how to view the world that looks at digital technology and how it can help companies create new and wondrous experiences that really fuse together the virtual and the real. So that's what I'm working on now.
Oh, now, see, that is one that will be very interesting to me because I have, transitioned from a consulting company where I was providing a service to people that I knew and had relationship with and now have transitioned into this new stage of reinvention with Solutions Live where I am dealing almost entirely electronically,
yep.
Both in trying to expand the business and in reaching out to the various authors that we have on the show. So I can't wait to hear about that framework. So what are the couple of tips that you would leave behind with people, really on the subject of growth, particularly in these really, really challenging times?
Yeah, well, one thing I would encourage people to think about is that growth is not a divine right. And growth sometimes isn't even the right thing to do, that there are some companies that ought to sort of stay where they are, that in growing they will basically destroy what makes them special. Those are probably few and far between, but it is something that particularly entrepreneurs should at least think about. Because then if they decide that this is something that I want to grow, this does make sense, well, then they can put their full heart into it without hesitation and then figure out how they can go about doing that. And I think the you go back to the whole panoply of ideas that we have, I mean, each one can help them grow. That think about how you not just mass produce what you're doing, but mass customize. So you can meet individual demand. So people don't have an excuse for not buying from you because you don't have exactly what they want. If you want to grow, think about growing not just in terms of goods and services, not just innovation in there, but what might be an experience innovation that you can create that will be a growth engine for your company. And as you grow, how do you maintain the authenticity that you did when you were small? Perhaps it was something that you didn't even have to think about, that it was organic, that it just happened. But now you need to realize that authenticity needs to be at the table for every decision that you make, because every decision is going to impact how people perceive you. And they need to perceive you as real, as genuine, as sincere, as original, as authentic.
Such great advice.
Chris, do you have any other questions that have been burning?
Thank you for asking. No, I think I'm still digesting, and I think it's so exciting to hear somebody talking about this, and it maps so well to the two previous authors that we just spoke to. I mean, I don't think this is amazingly cohesive morning, right, with heart-centered leadership, which is just another way of describing authenticity. And I think it just, morphs into authenticity of a corporation and a business. And I think Ben and Jerry's, Southwest Airlines, you know, some of these examples we're so used to, and everyone kind of looks at them as if they're unique, that you can't have that same experience or perception of a business, you know, if you're a bank or if you're, you know, one of these other industries. So I just think there's a lot of food for thought here.
All right. Well, Joe, thank you so much for making a repeat appearance. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I just can't wait to hear about your new book.
All right. Well, thank you, Chickie. It was a pleasure. It was a pleasure meeting you virtually, Chris.
Thank you very much.
Joe,
I look forward to it as well.
And Joe, can you remind people how they can learn more about your consulting practice?
Well, they can go to our website, www.strategichorizons.com. Learn all about our thoughts, our thinking, our ways of interacting with business, and what they can do about their own business.
Okay, terrific. Well, when you get your new book out, you're going to have to let me know, and we'll have you on again.
Absolutely.
Okay, Joe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
All right, terrific. Well, Chris, that was very, very interesting. And when you look at how all of these things build together, it just always amazes me that it paints such an incredible picture.
Well, you know, and with Joe just now, he really tied a lot of things to what you are now doing and what you have experienced yourself, right? You have shifted from this kind of one-off individual customer-driven service space to now digitally enhanced business, satisfying something you're passionate about and making sure that every time you interact with one of these authors, you're coming from the heart of your own authenticity. You're choosing authors and interviews according to what you believe, what you'd like to propagate in the business world, what you'd like to see more of. And I think that's wonderful, and it shows in the passion that you have in putting in the time, energy, and effort into Solutions Live.
Well, I appreciate that, and I found myself thinking about my tagline and the song that I've chosen as the theme song for the Solutions Live show, which is all about leaving a legacy. And it's not so much about me leaving a legacy, though. I mean, it really is about helping our listeners and both those who listen live and through the miracle of on-demand radio, who can listen to these shows really for months to come as the topic becomes relevant to them. And, you know, I think if we can listen to these things, and whether you're a corporate employee or even a corporate executive, you know, who does feel trapped, and if you had taken Pamela's quiz about are you a corporate casualty, you know, if you did that and decided that you need to leave, that you can actually think about what that legacy is going to look like, and not just for your kids, but, you know, 100 years from now, is anybody going to know your name? And if they do, is it going to be a good thing? I mean, I look when I first started looking into my family history and, you know, found that, you know, my great-great-grandfathers had been, you know, driven out of Georgia, you know, by a posse, you know, and eventually ended up in Texas and were linked with, you know, the James brothers and, you know, I mean, all kinds of awful things. And, you know, I mean, that's not what you want your legacy to be. And, you know, I mean, I happen to have an amazing family legacy. My mother's parents were missionaries in Pyongyang, North Korea, and my mother was born there, and my grandfather founded the Boy Scouts in Korea, and a couple of years ago, Chris, you remember we adopted a little boy from Russia 5 years ago, and when we went over to pick Sergei up, we decided to actually go through Seoul. The previous trip when we went over to meet him, we went through Moscow, which is really the long way around to get to Vladivostok, Russia. But at any rate, we're pulling into the Seoul airport, and I don't know what made this conversation start, because we hadn't had any dialogue with the people who sat next to us on the flight, but we were fortunate enough to have been able to use points to upgrade to first class. And this woman asked why we were coming to Korea, and I said, well, we're not actually coming to Korea. We're going on to Russia to pick up our son. And I said something about my mother having grown up in Korea. And she said, oh, where? And I said, Pyongyang. And she said, oh, well, you know, what was her last name? And I'm thinking, oh, you know, really? I can't believe she's asking me this. And I said, Shaw. And she said, was her father William Shaw? And it's like, yes. And she said, my father, who was sitting next to her but didn't speak any English, was in his Boy Scout troop. And I got to tell you, I got goosebumps all over, and I, you know, my parents unfortunately were already had already passed away by that time, but I thought, wow, what a legacy, you know, that I don't know how many years later, you know, 50, 60 years later, here I'm meeting this woman and this man who knew my grandfather. It was just amazing. So, you know, leaving behind a legacy is really important, and I think you can only do that with authenticity, and you can only do that by not being held captive in a job that you hate. And we're going to talk this afternoon. My co-host this afternoon is Tiffany Topsik, but you're absolutely welcome to join us, and we'll have a three-way conversation about some of this if you're available. Because, you know, if you look through at what Joe Pine talked about authenticity and what Susan talked about, you know, about the human elements of leadership, and you know, she didn't talk a lot about the cost of neglecting that human element, but I think a lot of us in our corporate careers, you know, we were the result of that, and we weren't nurtured, and we didn't have mentors, and we didn't have a corporate culture of apology.
You know, absolutely. And I think part of the change, though, has to come from within. Part of the change has to be that you decide in preparation, let's say you do decide that you must escape, you know, your corporate cubicle, but whatever role you're in, you need to make that shift while you're there. You know, your life inside that cubicle or inside that corporation might be better if you decided to find your own authenticity and live it daily in that environment, regardless of the fears that you have about that. Right? So part of making yourself healthier, part of even preparing, I think, for leaving corporate and corporate world is to start being authentic where you find yourself. And some of that could make your environment or make your corporate, the perspective you have on the corporate world, or even the perspective people have of you within your corporate world, different, very different. You know, there's a courage that takes.
Right.
But it's the same kind of courage that it takes to step out and try something new. So, you know, I think there's something to be said for trying it in your current environment and seeing if you can shift the experience that you're having.
Right.
So, I know that you are a big proponent for leaving corporate environment.
Well, yeah,
but as
I mean,
someone who's gone back
and
forth, right? Mm-hmm. I'm just someone who's gone back and forth, as you know, from the entrepreneur to the corporate to the back to the forth. You know, nothing driven me like needing to have the medical insurance, you know, for having a baby or anything like that. But there's something to be said for that, and there's something to be said for just, you know, that
circle of influence that you have and helping other people's lives in a small, small way, setting an example in a culture that doesn't have a lot of authenticity, trying to set the example of that behavior for other people. And it can have a ripple effect and can slowly make change. Maybe not enough, and maybe it is time to leave, but at least you can practice that. Get yourself ready.
Right. Well, that, you know, that's the really important thing, though, Chris. And you know, I am only a strong proponent of me leaving corporate America.
I know.
Not everyone else, although it really frustrates me to see people who, you know, who perhaps do have the freedom and flexibility, whether because they've got, you know, have done a really good job at saving and staying out of debt, or they do have a spouse who could sustain them, you know, because they are living within their means and don't.
Absolutely.
Or don't live in a place, you know, like Pamela said, you know, she and her husband live in New York City, and, you know, it's really tough with the cost of living there or the cost of living in California or Seattle, you know, to live on a single salary. But, you know, if you do have that freedom and flexibility and you've also got creativity and innovation burning with you and nobody's listening.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And like I said, you know, it was so funny because I was in, you know, I must not be a very fast learner because I was in corporate life for 20 years. And I remember when I was at WorldSpan, my boss, Lou Ellsworthy, you know, kind of took me aside and told me that I rubbed people the wrong way and that he was going to send me to corporate charm school, which, you know, when I look back, it was like the most amazing thing that he did. I mean, it was kind of like your experience that you had a few weeks ago at Yale, only I got sent to Carmel, California, to a small, you know, coaching environment with 10 other people. It was an AM, American Management Association program, and it was just astounding.
Oh, much better than 7-degree snow in New Haven.
Yeah, definitely. although your program sounded amazing too. But this program, you know, when I walked in the room and I told people that I was being sent there because I rubbed people the wrong way, you know, the reaction was, but when you walk into the room, you light everything up. And, you know, when I left that program, I actually had to buy myself a necklace that was a sun to remind myself of that when I would get in these awful corporate situations where the reason I was rubbing people the wrong way is I couldn't stand the status quo, which is
right.
Why, you know, my consulting firm thrived, you know, for 10 out of the last 13 years before I decided to, you know, build a new technology company. And, you know, I think if I can just help even one person figure out that it's not just them, you know,
right.
That maybe they haven't discovered where they're going to be really, really happy. Now, obviously, there's the corollary of having to be able to make money at what you're doing. And you know, I am constantly accountable to my business partner and life partner and husband of 18 years of trying to make sure that we've got the money that we need to do what we're doing. But, you know, I forget whether it was Susan who mentioned it or Pamela, you know, we're taking steps right now. I think I mentioned to you last week, we're going through Dave Ramsey's financial Peace University course. Our church happens to be offering it, and it's a 13-week course to really get on the path to get out of debt forever and to not carry that generational curse to your children of thinking that, you know, as soon as they get that first credit card offer, you know, when they're in college or that student loan that, you know, years later they haven't paid off, you know, that you won't be a prisoner to your debt. And the thing I love about the program, he said, just look around any city in this country and see what the tallest buildings are. It's the banks. And that's no accident. It's the banks and financial institutions. And, you know, we have to make sure we're building our own houses and our own businesses that are going to stand taller than that because they stand on a really firm foundation of being happy with what you're doing, being authentic, and just living right. And I think we're learning in this current economic crisis that, you know, you just can't live beyond your means. And our country's living beyond its means right now, and that's pretty scary.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that's exactly right. And I think it's understanding your financial situation
And understanding debt and what kind of debt you should take on is a key foundational piece of being authentic in yourself. And to Joe's point, being authentic as a corporation. I mean, when you look at the list of companies who are going bankrupt and will probably go bankrupt this year, they had overextended. You know, Krispy Kreme, why did they have financial problems? Because they left their roots and they expanded too fast, driving to the concept of revenue growth when, again, to his point, sometimes growing is not what you need to do,
right.
At least not in that way, right? So this whole concept of living off of debt, living off of the future, and thinking that revenue or appreciation in things that you own or some of those things are a divine right, right? That
right.
Everything is always going to go up. Those aren't. And authenticity is facing reality.
Right.
Facing the reality of what you can afford, not what the Joneses have across the street. What can you afford, and what can you afford in dire situations? You know, what can you afford if you do become a one-income family? What can you afford if, I don't know, whatever, if parents have to come live with you? What
right.
can you afford in the environment that you find yourself in? And, you know, what does that take? And do you need to have, you know, all the things that you need to have, like the 400 channels on cable? But I'm not about to recommend that anybody give that up. So I love my DVR.
Well, it's also tough when you've got an 8 and a 10-year-old. Anytime we contemplate giving up some of those channels, we always end up having to lop off ones that impact the kids.
Absolutely,
so,
and that's so, you know, and having
well, and that,
children
clearly,
as well makes it
design.
Really tough. You know,
yeah.
depending on what environment you're in and kind of what the other parents are doing. You know, I can't imagine sometimes if we had to give a bat mitzvah or bar mitzvah or had a, you know, quinceanera that we had to put on or something like that to compete with the children and, you know, that and the other families and what
really,
they're
or
doing.
Even just the birthday party. I mean, the last time that Joe was on, we talked about his book, The Experience Economy, which talks about what's happened. I mean, since you and I were little and having birthday parties with, you know, pin the tail on the donkey and a, you know, a cake. And I don't even remember if we had
the backyard,
it,
the grill, the cake, maybe
right.
one of those little pool things that you filled with the hose.
Right, right. And now, I mean, they are just such amazing productions. And I mean, just the goodie bags that you have to buy for the people who come to the party. You know, so not only are the kids bringing gifts to the party, but the host gives gifts to the kids. That's like, what's that all about? But you know, it's that keeping up with the Joneses stuff that I think has gotten this country, you know, to where it is, and being desensitized to, and you know, I mean, I love Starbucks, so you know, I don't want to be putting them down as a company, but being desensitized to spending $5 for coffee, and you know, I don't remember whether you were on the phone. I don't think so, as my co-host last week when we had a call-in from a missionary in Guatemala who was asking about this new business idea that he had about selling coffee, incredible coffee, on the Internet for $9 to $10 a pound. And, you know, at first, you know, I'm thinking, oh, wow, that sounds like a lot. And then I'm thinking, holy cats, do you know how much I pay for a cup of Starbucks, you know, if you prorate that out by the pound, it's probably $100, right?
Exactly.
And you know, his business scheme is, and I don't use the term scheme in a negative way, is, you know, to take a portion of that and actually turn it back around to whatever nonprofit or ministry that you want to support. And you know, it's funny because, you know, we spend money without thinking, or we have in the past. And I don't know about you, Chris, but, you know, even people who aren't facing, you know, severe financial, you know, troubles or a situation like, you know, what we just went through of 2.5 years of investing in a business that didn't end up producing the results that we had expected. But, you know, we're looking at every expenditure, and we're getting really, really creative. And you know what? Part of that is actually fun for me. And because I was the worst kind of spender that, you know, would pick up, a gourmet cheese and not even notice that it cost $13. Now if I pick that up, I can't put it in my shopping basket. Even if I had the $13, I don't think I'm going to go back to that kind of spending.
Absolutely. I'm there with you. You know, and I think it's a decision now on what, you know, not just, what do you want your experiences to be, right?
Right, and that legacy that you're leaving behind.
Exactly. And we're becoming more, I think, better consumers. We are making it harder for those inauthentic companies to pull the wool over us. We're making choices. You know, we're not buying five pairs of shoes. We're buying one. You know, we're just we're shopping at the consignment stores. We're doing a lot of things very differently, and we're deciding, you know what, we do want to go out to dinner, let's say.
Right.
Which place do we want to go? And we're not going three times a week and not even thinking about it and showing up. We're deciding what kind of experience we want to have and making it more important, which also means that it's going to be much harder for these companies to keep us and for us to come back and be the repeat customers that we used to be, because we're not going to be as forgiving.
Right, right.
So,
well, I think that's
yeah.
really true. And we're also training up the next generation to behave differently. And, I mean, we had the dialogue at dinner last night.
Absolutely. Not to be just blown over by marketing, to understand what marketing is.
Well, not only that, I mean, what Dave Ramsey's program promotes with kids is that when they are 14, you actually get them a checking account with a debit card, not a credit card, and that you fund that bank account for all the things that you normally buy for the child. Now, obviously, the child has to be, you know, a little bit responsible at that juncture, and maybe you do it at 16 and not at 14. But basically, you know, the money that you would spend on clothes and shampoo and, you know, face creams if you've got a girl who, you know, is going to get into makeup and different things, and that they then get to choose how they spend that money. And if they choose to blow it all on, you know, the greatest outfit or the greatest new Wii toy or whatever, that there isn't money left over for the things that they want. And, you know, man, I said to my husband last week when we were on our way home, and, I mean, I love my parents to death, but, you know, they didn't teach me about money. And they didn't teach me about making those kinds of sensible decisions. They didn't teach me about saving. Oh, you know what, I don't want to go through my life again, so I'm going to say what I wouldn't give to be 25. I wouldn't want to go back and be 25 again, by the way. But if I were 25, I would start saving $169 a week or $1,000 a year for 7 years and be a millionaire when I was 50 or 55 instead of, you know, having to go to Financial Peace University at age 51.
Right.
You know, and I say that, and I say that in a spirit of self-disclosure, because I want other people to know that it's okay. In fact, it's great to admit that kind of weakness, because that's what it takes to get on the other side of it and to be strong at the end.
Yes.
So I'm looking for great authors to talk about personal finance. So if any of our guests who are listening today, or those who are going to listen in the coming days by downloading these shows, have any ideas for guests that we ought to consider on the show, maybe your favorite author, on any topic. And on the show on Tuesdays, we address innovation at 10. 10:30, we talk about leadership. 11 o'clock, we talk about growth. And if we don't have an author at the 11:30 slot, Chris and I are going to continue to do this new book club, where we talk about the things we've just heard and perhaps our favorite books that we've just read. I also have a number of great speakers out into the future of people who are actually living a legacy of another generation. And whether it's a parent or a grandparent, or maybe it's just a good family friend who set an example and opened a door that the next generation has taken on. I think that's going to be a fascinating slot. And you know, you and I were talking earlier about perhaps getting together with Pamela and interviewing some of her corporate escape artists. I think that would be great fun. And then on Thursdays, our topics are wellness and life balance, which beginning a week from Thursday, we're going to be doing that show every week with Phil and Amy Parham, who are on the show a few weeks ago. They were NBC's Biggest Losers in the finalists last season. And we are going to do a 90-day fitness challenge, which I am looking forward to doing myself. I think that's going to be the thing that finally gets me out of my chair and away from my computer and out taking a walk. And then, as I mentioned, financial health is a big topic right now. The 11 a.m. slot on Thursday is Giving in Faith, and then the 11:30 slot, again, if we have a guest to talk about social networking, it will be about that. If not, Chris and I are going to do another wrap-up just like this. So, Chris, have you read anything interesting lately? I know you've been busy kind of transitioning from your corporate life back into, you know, figuring out where you're going and what you want to be.
Well, you know, actually, I read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And usually when I'm working really hard, as in, you know, have big clients or something like that, then I tend to relax with fiction. And lately, though, because I don't have that, I'm finding myself reading more on both business side and kind of the self-improvement, you know, things like what Pamela, Susan, and Joe have been talking about, whether it's business books of improvement or how you to personally improve your own leadership. And something that I found recently, and I'm actually going to a seminar on this on Friday, which goes straight to authenticity and to financial as well, is a woman named Byron Katie, who wrote a book called Loving What Is. Mm-hmm. And basically that's about letting go of the stories you tell yourself. You know, like I should live right. in a big house, or I should drive this really fancy car, or I should have a much better job, or whatever it is. And facing the reality of where you are today. Because unless you figure out where you are today, you can't get to those things.
Right.
Right? Because if you can't afford the big house or the car, and you're telling yourself you should, and you're actually spending that kind of money, you're putting yourself in a place where you'll never actually be able to enjoy those things.
Right.
Right? So Loving What is kind of the thing I'm looking into right now, and I'll share with you, if appropriate, or if it matches to anything that we do next week, anything
well,
that I learned.
I love that. I love that, Chris. And I think I was sharing with you guys the other night at the Executive Girlfriends Group dinner in Dallas a book that I read called The Present. And it's another one of those just short allegorical books that fundamentally talks about focusing everything on the present. In, you know, the slice of time versus, you know, the present actually being, you know, a physical gift. But the picture on the front of the book is that gift, and that when you spend all of your time looking in the past or all of your time dreaming about the future, you don't get a chance to love what is. And, you know, I thought about that even in relation to our finances, you know, that when you're in debt, you're constantly forced to look back or to try to, you know, figure out how not to panic about the future, and you don't get to enjoy today.
Oh, it's a very, very unnerving, anxiety-producing place.
Right.
And you can't develop yourself and your future from a place of such angst. You need to find the peace. I love the name of this course that you're going through, Financial Peace University.
Right.
I mean, I think that's so telling. It's so right. Because when you find peace, that's when your mind calms, your soul calms,
yep.
and you can actually find who you are, what makes you passionate, what makes you, you know, what makes you go. Find those things that help you move forward and be as authentic as you can be, because you're in a place where you can discover that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Chris, this is, I mean, not that I didn't enjoy our guests, because I really did, all three of them.
Absolutely,
were incredible.
And once again, the way they go together
oh,
and the
no.
way they segue into each other, which, of course, is never planned, Just wonderful.
But it's
again.
A gorgeous tapestry. It always comes out that way, and I am still so excited that we get a shot at talking to Pamela again this afternoon, because I think really helping people explore this whole notion of a practical guide to creating the career of your dreams is something that so many people need right now, and they need some level of peace in their lives, and having clarity of vision, you know, actually I think is a way to get that peace in your life. So, well, Chris, it has been terrific. So I will talk to you again.
Thank you again, Chickie. Have
okay.
a great week.
Great.
Don't mind if you got something nice to say about me. I enjoy an accolade like the rest. You could take my picture and hang it in a gallery of all the who's who's and so-and-so's that used to be the best.
Insights on social networking and faith in the marketplace. Go out and begin to leave your legacy today.